Good evening and welcome. My name is Hal Jones. I'm the director of the Robin Meir American Institute, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all here for the annual Wynant Lecture in American Government to be delivered by our John G. Wynant Visiting Professor in American Government, Sidney Milkus. Sidney Milkus comes to us from the University of Virginia, where he's the White Burkett Miller Professor in the Department of Politics and a faculty associate at the Miller Center. He's an authority on the party system and the presidency in the United States. His books include The President and the Parties, The Transformation of the American Party System Since the New Deal, Political Parties and Constitutional Government, Remaking American Democracy, and Theodore Roosevelt, The Progressive Party and the Transformation of American Democracy. It's been a real pleasure to have Sid here with us from this term, and his arrival's been extremely timely with such intense interest in all aspects of American politics at the current moment. He's been a very generous contributor to many of the discussions that we've had here over these past few weeks. And so it's a real pleasure, Sid, to welcome you. Sid will be giving a lecture entitled Joining the Revolution, Lyndon Johnson, the Modern Presidency, and the Civil Rights Movement. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening. Can you all hear me? Because the IT people think I have such a big mouth, I didn't need a mic. So, but Alan, you tell me if I'm not projecting. I want to start by thanking Joe Wynant and the Wynant family for allowing me to participate in this distinctive honor to be the John Wynant Chair. I've had a lot of academic honors. I hope you don't mind me saying, but. This is really a capstone for me. I'm really thrilled to be in this position. I also want to thank my master, Drummond Bone, who's been very welcoming to me at Balliol, and except for putting on a few pounds every Wednesday night with those fantastic faculty dinners. It's been a great opportunity for me. And of course, I want to thank the people from the Rothmere Institute. Nigel Bowles, who's back there, who is the director, when I was awarded the chair, and Hal Jones, who's been just very welcoming, and Hugh David, who's worked so hard to set this event up. There it is. Hugh did everything but write this lecture. I think it would be better if he wrote it, but you'll have to listen to me. And thank you all for coming. I believe in Tocqueville's refrain that an American will give a lecture to one person, but I am deeply grateful that you showed up here tonight. The title of my talk this evening is inspired by a comment the civil rights activist James Farmer of the civil rights group the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, made in the wake of Lyndon Johnson's joint speech to Congress on March 15, 1965. The president's dramatic conclusion to that speech expressed the White House's unyielding support for Martin Luther King Jr., the inspiring leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the brave civil rights activists who were demonstrating against racial discrimination in Selma, Alabama. The Selma demonstrations targeted restrictions on voting behavior that, for all intents and purposes, really had rendered the 15th Amendment to the Constitution meaningless in the South. The highlight of the speech was both familiar and powerful. We shall overcome. This dramatic invocation, with this dramatic invocation, Johnson adopted as his own rallying cry a line from an old hymn that had become the slogan of the Civil Rights Movement. Johnson's speech resonated powerfully with civil rights activists, many of whom had a skeptical view that he could be a worthy ally in the quest for racial equality. And they felt that way even after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which breathed new life into the 14th Amendment and its guarantee of citizenship to all citizens born or naturalized in the United States. The skepticism was understandable. After all, prior to his embrace of the civil rights movement, Johnson had made his mark not as a reformer, but as a ruthlessly effective power broker in the Senate. Yet after this nationalized television address, which contributed significantly to moving the 1965 Voting Rights Act through a resisting Congress, where it was still waiting final passage, James Farmer led a march to the White House to express the civil rights activists' support for the president's efforts. And Farmer said, when President Johnson said, "We shall overcome," he joined the civil rights revolution. And he continued, "Now it's up to you and me," to him and the marchers, "to keep him in it, to keep the president in it, to keep him and our friends in Congress moving. If we let up the pressure, they let up progress." Now, Farmer's ambivalent tribute, expressing the great appreciation for the president's support, but at the same time, the need for activists to keep the pressure on the White House, underscores the argument of my talk. That is, the historic civil rights reforms of the 1960s were conceived by an uneasy but critical relationship. It was a mating dance between a reform president intent on leveraging a cresting grassroots movement to stake his place in history, and a civil rights movement that was determined to exploit the powers of the modern presidency in pursuit of its goals. Now, it seems improbable, at least that's what most people say who read my stuff, that presidents and social movements could join forces in bringing about fundamental change. Most historians and political scientists tend to see inherent tension between top-down and bottom-up politics, between a centralizing institution like the American presidency, sworn to preserve the Constitution, and grassroots associations like the civil rights movement, dedicated to structural change. Like the other great historical example of a president and a social movement resulting in a historical breakthrough for racial justice, that is, Lincoln and the abolitionist movement, there surely were conflicts and rivalries between Lyndon Johnson and civil rights leaders. But for the first 3 years of his presidency, LBJ and key civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., John Lewis, and James Farmer recognized that they needed each other. And although this partnership between LBJ and civil rights activists was short-lived, and eventually unraveled, the formative and contentious relationship between the White House and civil rights activists, as Dr. King put it, was a shining moment, a critical chapter in the development of American politics. Now, the momentous relationship between LBJ and the civil rights movement was not cut out of whole cloth. It marked, in fact, a development more than 50 years in the making. Constrained by constitutional norms, the separation and division of powers, and a decentralized party system, the presidency's disruptive potential of executive power that Jefferson worried so much about, was outside of political crises and war limited until the 20th century. But with the advent of the modern presidency during the progressive era, that is the reform period during the first two decades of the 20th century, the White House was more likely to challenge the existing order of things. To be sure, modern executives regularly shied away from close relationships with controversial social movements, especially those that fought against the deeply embedded disease of racial injustice. Nevertheless, the consolidation of the modern presidency during the long reign of Franklin Roosevelt, he would still be president had he not died, and the New Deal realignment that took place during his presidency invested the executive with powers and public expectations that made the White House a critical agent of social and economic reform. And once the White House became the center of growing government commitments, its occupants were more likely to profess support for the same high ideals that prominent civil rights activists championed. But insurgents knew all too well that modern presidents still could be unreliable and cagey political partners. They could also be cautious opponents to many of their disruptive tactics and ambitious ends. During the presidencies of Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, presidents sought to find, as the political scientist Bruce Miroff puts it, a balance point where they appeared to cooperate with civil rights activists for noble purposes, but at the same time sought to maintain a safe distance from the enervating battles that were that would fracture their parties and rattle the nation. Lyndon Johnson risked closing this space. Only with Johnson was the full panoply of modern presidential powers, political, administrative, and rhetorical, deployed on behalf of insurgent interests and insurgent demands. Johnson claimed broad authority to transform domestic policy on his own terms at a time when Congress and parties were subordinate to the modern president, a modern presidency at high tide, and a national bureaucracy unprecedentedly expansive. This was also the period when the civil rights movement's ability to blend and balance collective action and conventional political pressure was at its zenith. Consequently, Johnson and the civil rights movement formed a more direct and combustible relationship than was true of previous combinations for collaborations between presidents and social movements. The result was both an historic body of civil rights reforms and enormous political fallout for Johnson and the Democratic Party. Now, of course, when Johnson assumed the presidency, he had reasons for taking this risk, for taking a strong civil rights stand. By this time, the Solid South was no more, as Dwight Eisenhower had won a substantial amount of support below the Mason-Dixon line. The best hope for establishing an executive-centered liberal coalition lay in expanding the African-American vote. Moreover, Johnson felt he had to prove himself to African-American leaders who were suspicious of a Southern president, the first Southern president since Andrew Johnson. And he had to prove himself to Northern liberals as well, who had become strongly committed to the civil rights cause after the demonstrations of Birmingham, Alabama, and the March on Washington in 1963. LBJ intended to prove his worthiness to the growing civil rights movement by carrying out, indeed surpassing, the civil rights program of the Kennedy administration. Now, beyond political strategy, more than the charismatic but cautious JFK, Johnson wanted to make his own historic mark on the presidency. And he viewed civil rights reform and an alliance with leaders of the civil rights movement as critical to the success of his ambition. LBJ's enormous reform ambition is often overlooked. He's frequently depicted as Robert Caro, the author of a multi-volume biography. I almost said a mighty multi-volume biography, has characterized him as a ruthless power broker. Or as one of Johnson's aides, John Roach, put it to me, as lacking an ideological chromosome. Without question, Johnson loved power, and he was more than willing to use it ruthlessly, both as Senate leader and as president. But once he ascended to the presidency, Johnson was determined to deploy power to make history. He wanted, as he said modestly, to be the greatest of them all. LBJ's obsession with his legacy was revealed in his reaction to his 1964 landslide victory over Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater. Although it was clear that he had won easily soon after the polls closed, Johnson refused to celebrate. Instead, he was very grumpy. He was grumpy until it was confirmed early the next morning that he had won 61% of the popular vote, and thus surpassed FDR's triumph over Governor Alf Landon in 1936. Only when it was known that he had won the greatest popular landslide in history did LBJ feel triumphant. Johnson meant to use this historic landslide to build a new progressive coalition. LBJ and aides like Richard Goodwin and Bill Moyers believed that the social movements that emerged during the 60s suggested that ideas and practices that were marginal during the New Deal might become the foundation of a new reform program. Johnson intended to align himself with African Americans and women and environmentalists, and he saw their causes as evidence that the country, enjoying unprecedented wealth and power, was ready for leadership committed not just to economic reform, but also to fundamental social justice. The cresting civil rights movement in particular, Johnson and his more progressive aides believe, demonstrated the unsuspected vulnerability in America to liberating changes. LBJ yearned for a great society, not just another deal, and the struggle of African Americans to fulfill their rights lay at the heart of this aspiration. Viewing the growing civil rights movement as an opportunity for the White House to forge a new reform coalition, Johnson was scornful of the Kennedy administration's cautious moves towards federal intervention in race relations. Although Dr. King and other civil rights leaders urged JFK to take a strong moral stand on the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation in January of 1963, President Kennedy, fearing his words would invite comparison with Abraham Lincoln's, and therefore disrupt the fragile New Deal coalition of Northern and Southern Democrats, chose not to attend the ceremony at the Lincoln Memorial. Adding insult to injury, Kennedy's tape-recorded address, civil rights leaders lamented, appeared to consign race problems generally to the past. Referencing how the country had slouched towards progress since the seminal Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education, in 1954, Kennedy praised African Americans for their patient efforts, as he put it, to convert freedom from rhetoric to reality. JFK thereby ignored the hard fact that Supreme Court decisions, even dramatic ones like the Brown decision, which overthrew the long-standing doctrine of separate but equal, and called for the end of forced segregation of schools in the South, would be empty pronouncements without the support of the White House. In contrast to Kennedy's forbearance, Vice President Johnson jumped at the chance to identify with Lincoln. He eagerly accepted an invitation to give a 1963 memorial address commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, where Lincoln had famously called for a new birth of freedom. Rather than demur as JFK had on a momentous occasion, Johnson's address exalted the demands of the civil rights movement. He exalted the demands of the civil rights movement for a full-scale and programmatic assault on racial injustice. 100 years ago, the slave was free, Johnson reminded his audience. Sorry, I'm doing Johnson in a Philadelphia accent. 100 years later, he continued, the Negro remains in bondage to the color of his skin. The Negro today asks justice. We do not answer him. We do not answer those who lie beneath the soil when we reply to the Negro by asking patience. Celebrated by several African American newspapers, including the Baltimore African American, which praised it as an eloquent address, worthy of the warmest applause of the African American community, LBJ's Gettysburg address became, as the popular syndicated columnist Drew Pearson reported a sort of Emancipation Proclamation for the Kennedy administration. And then Pearson continued in his column, some of the White House functionaries were irked that it was the vice president, not the president, who made this proclamation. I'm old enough that I remember reading Drew Pearson. Now, Pearson also added that some of these critics, some of JFA's critics, were upset that on a recent trip to the South, Kennedy talked about the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the race for the moon, and the importance of law and order, but said not a word about social justice. Only in the Birmingham violence during the fall of 1963, when four young girls were killed in a church bombing, did JFK and his aides begin to acknowledge that their efforts for reform were hampered by the White House's failure, as Theodore Sorensen wrote in a memo, either to make an all-out fight for legislation or to engage the civil rights movement in such a cause. Tragically, Kennedy was assassinated before he and his aides could act on this regret. But once president, Johnson was determined not to make the same mistake. Echoing the fervent commitment of his Gettysburg Address in May 1964, he delivered an electrifying, and I think courageous, speech at a breakfast attended by members of the Georgia State Legislature in Atlanta, the city that General William Tecumseh Sherman had burned to the ground a century earlier. The time had come for justice among the races, Johnson declared, and he would never feel that he had done justice to his high office, the national constitutional office, so long as old hatreds that sustained the stubborn tumor of forced segregation continued to divide the country, continued to tarnish the American creed. Georgians helped write the Constitution. Georgians had fought and Georgians had died to protect the Constitution, he stated firmly. Because the Constitution requires it, he continues. Because justice demands it, we must protect the constitutional rights of all our citizens, regardless of race, religion, or the color of their skin. Johnson's resolve to take the civil rights fight into the Deep South didn't completely sway his audience. Still, the overall response to the president's visit, maybe because he was a Southerner himself, was remarkably positive. Only the unrepentant state writer, Senator Richard Russell, of all the important Georgia politicians, boycotted Johnson's visit to Georgia. And LBJ's strong stance below the Mason-Dixon line reverberated far beyond Georgia's borders. In going before the Democratic leaders of a Southern state to give an unflinching defense of civil rights, he gained the hard-won respect of Northern liberals and civil rights leaders. President Johnson has shown remarkable fortitude in carrying his message of racial equality and unity into Georgia, the heart of the old Southern Confederacy, proclaimed the very prominent African-American newspaper, the Chicago Daily Defender. This enthusiastic praise, characteristic of the African-American press, was echoed by the mainstream media. It was becoming of the President of the United States, a Washington Post editorial declared, that he should make such a forthright statement below the Mason-Dixon line. Johnson's widely praised trip to Georgia strengthened his resolve to push the 1964 civil rights legislation through Congress. His greatest strength as majority leader of the Senate had been his personal persuasion. And armed by the moral capital he gained in Georgia, he now used that talent to convince Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen to endorse the 1965 Civil Rights Bill, and critically, to enlist moderate Republicans in a cloture vote to end the filibuster against the 64 Civil Rights Bill, a tactic that had blocked civil rights reforms since the 1930s. That support didn't come without a price. Dirksen exacted some important compromises to the equal employment provisions of the bill that reduced the power of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, charged with preventing racial and sexual discrimination, which was also part of Title VII of the Civil Rights Bill, in the workplace. Reduced its power to reduce discrimination in the workplace to cases of obvious discriminatory practices that characterized the Jim Crow laws in the South. As a result, Northern businesses would be protected from bureaucratic and legal scrutiny. Still, the principal objective, which was still highly controversial, of the Civil Rights Bill, eliminating the entrenched segregation in the South from schools, the workplace, and places of public accommodation like hotels and restaurants, that was preserved. Now, Dirksen's support of the Civil Rights Bill, a gesture of bipartisanship that rarely occurs any longer in American politics, also followed from his concern for historical fame. Showing he knew how to flatter, as well as horse trade, LBJ told Dirksen from Illinois that this was his opportunity to prove himself a worthy leader of what once was Lincoln's party. As he told the GOP senator, the GOP Senate leader, "You come with me on this bill, and 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen." Johnson knew that some senators would believe that stuff. Having reached for the Lincoln mantle himself, LBJ knew ambitious senators like Dirksen could be persuaded to rise above narrow partisanship. And the bipartisan alliance that Johnson and Dirksen formed sounded the death knell for the conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans against civil rights. For the first time in American history, the Senate voted cloture against a Southern filibuster designed to foster a civil rights bill, and did so by a considerable margin of 71 to 29. And once the filibuster was killed, Congress passed the bill quickly, and Johnson signed it on July 2, 1964. The enactment of the Civil Rights Act, the first in 1964, which was overwhelmingly opposed by Southern Democrats in the House and Senate, revealed, I think, how the modern presidency's relationship with social movements had begun to transcend the White House's link to parties. Throughout the fight for this legislation, Johnson drew strength from and collaborated with civil rights leaders. He even enlisted the cooperation of these leaders to calm urban unrest during the summer of 1964, the first of the long hot summers. Riots erupted in July of that year, soon after the Republican National Convention nominated the arch-conservative Goldwater, who voted against the Civil Rights Bill. As the rioting spread to several urban areas, including New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, in Jersey City, the Johnson administration feared that racial unrest would turn white voters against a president identified with the cause of African Americans. Towards the end of July, at LBJ's request, the leaders of the major civil rights organizations, including Dr. King, held a meeting in New York City, where they called for a moratorium on protests, a moratorium even on nonviolent protests. The moratorium, they assured the restless foot soldiers of effective nonviolent demonstrations, only marked, as the moratorium put it, a temporary change of emphasis and tactic, so that civil rights forces could, again, as the manifesto put it, be used to encourage the Negro people north and south to register and vote. In another, even more controversial collaboration between LBJ and the civil rights movement, most civil rights activists accepted the compromise that the Johnson White House struck with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the MFDP, at the 1964 Democratic Convention, which was held in Atlantic City at the end of the summer. That convention, of course, nominated Johnson for president and Hubert Humphrey for vice president. As Dr. King admitted, this concession, even more than the moratorium on demonstrations, caused a great sense of distress. The MFDP was an insurgent movement that challenged the Lily White delegation that the regular Mississippi Democratic Party selected to represent the state at the National Convention. Its spiritual leader was Fannie Lou Hamer. I always want to say Hammer. Throw that extra M in there, because she was a hammer. The MFDP co-chair and a former tenant farm who argued with great effect in televised hearings that it would be the height of hypocrisy for the Democrats to claim to be the party of social justice, of racial justice, and accept white supremacist state delegations at their convention. Following Hammer's powerful testimony, the White House received 417 telegrams, all but one in supporting the Freedom Democrats. But fearful that seating the Mississippi insurgents would lead Southern Democrats to stage an embarrassing exodus from the convention, Johnson, with the help of Humphrey, worked out, or I should say forced, because Johnson was ruthless here, a compromise. The compromise plan included three provisions: the seating of the regular Lily White Mississippi delegation, provided its members signed a loyalty oath that pledged them to support the presidential ticket; the symbolic gesture of making MFDP delegates honored guests at the convention, where two of its members would serve as special delegates at large with voting rights, to the dismay, though, of militant MFDP activists like Bob Moses, Hamer was not selected as one of those two delegates. Bob Moses, who was the field director for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party's efforts in Mississippi, told one of my friends that after that compromise, he never wanted to talk to a white person again. But he has talked to me, so he doesn't hold a grudge forever. And then the third part, a prohibition of racial discrimination in delegate selection at the 1968 Democratic Convention, to be enforced by a special committee that would assist state parties in complying with its expectations. The MFDP controversy bitterly divided civil rights activists, leaving scars that eventually would result in a full-blown crisis for Johnson and the civil rights movement. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee head, John Lewis, the head of SNCC, and the Congress of Racial Equality, headed by the aforementioned James Farmer, they were opposed to the moratorium on direct action, but they were outraged by the White House's willingness to sacrifice the MFDP's moral cause on the altar of expediency. That compromise confirmed, they argued, that LBJ was an unreliable partner, that he was an unprincipled power broker. Still, the MFDP, through its lawyer John Rao, joined King and most moderate civil rights leaders in swallowing the compromise. Not only were Southern states threatening to walk out of the convention if the regular Mississippi delegation was purged, but Johnson and the Democratic leaders also warned civil rights leaders that an unruly convention telecast on national television would cost the party the support of several border states, and therefore deprive Democrats of a chance to win an historic landslide, and therefore a mandate for further reform. Just as important, LBJ's strong support for the third piece of this compromise, which called for a fundamental reform of the Democratic Party's convention rules, helped to diffuse the Mississippi controversy. Previously, state parties had the sole authority to establish delegate selection procedures. Johnson proposed solution to the MFDP compromise established the centralizing principle that starting in 1968, the party councils would decide not only how many votes each state delegation got at the national convention, but also inform uniform rules on the kind of persons who could be selected to serve in these delegations. As the president, told the progressive labor leader Walter Reuther, who helped him work out this compromise with the civil rights activists, he wanted this conveyed to them. He said, "We don't want to cut off our nose to spite our faces. If they," meaning the MFDP protesters, "give us 4 years, I'll guarantee the Freedom Delegation or somebody representing their views like that will be seated in 1968. And that's just what happened. Having found no evidence that the 1968 Mississippi Democratic Party had complied either with the spirit or the letter of the convention call prohibiting racial discrimination, the Credentials Committee voted overwhelmingly to bar the Mississippi Regular Democrats from its seats. A biracial delegation, including many members of the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Party, were seated in its place. Consequently, for all the trauma the fraught MFDP compromise resulted in, it led to the transformation of the Democratic Party. It was a key moment in the transformation of the Democratic Party. This was the moment, I think, when the civil rights groups came to rival, if not replace, labor as the core constituency of the Democratic Party. When economic security, as important as it was it supplanted in important ways by a commitment to forming a more perfect union. While union leaders urged the president to seek a repeal of the notoriously anti-labor Taft-Hartley Act in the wake of his landslide victory, the law enacted over Truman's veto in 1946 that severely weakened the rights of workers to bargain collectively, Johnson chided them for discriminating against African Americans. The unions were highly segregated. And rather than pursue labor reform, the president set out to strengthen his alliance with civil rights activists, to join them in a fight for voting rights legislation. After the passage of the first Civil Rights Act, most of his White House aides urged LBJ to go slow on the explosive issue of voting rights. Even after he and the Democratic Party had won an historic victory in the 1964 election, most of his aides insisted this was a fight that he could not win, and he should not risk the fortunes of the Democratic Party and the Great Society on that kind of fight. Now, according to the movie Selma, I don't know how many of you have seen that movie, but according to that movie, Johnson heeded this advice, right? And he resisted Martin Luther King's determination to fight for a major voting rights bill. But in reality, Johnson was determined to seize the initiative. In fact, this time, unlike 1964, the president encouraged his civil rights allies not to compromise, but rather to disrupt politics as usual, as a spur to action, to put pressure on Congress. White House tapes of LBJ's conversations in the Oval Office reveal that on January 15, 1965, Johnson put in a call to Dr. King on the occasion of the civil rights leader's 36th birthday. And to the surprise of Dr. King, who was skeptical that LBJ would move on voting rights immediately in the afterglow of his historic landslide, thinking Johnson would go after education reform next, Johnson urged the civil rights leader to put pressure on Congress by protesting. And I'm going to take we're going to take a 3-minute interlude from my remarks, just to listen to an excerpt from this tape of Johnson and Martin Luther King's conversation. You should be able to hear it, but you have the text. See how well organized we are? You have the text with you, and Johnson is telling, arguing here, King can barely get a word in edgewise, as you'll see, that the civil rights leaders should hold demonstrations against literacy tests that scandalously denied African Americans their constitutional right to vote. And I've left this to Jane because I knew I would screw this up.
There's not going to be anything, though, Doctor, as effective as all of them voting. That'll get you a message that all the eloquence in the world won't bring, because the fellow will be coming to you then instead of you calling him.
And it's very interesting, Mr. President, to notice that the only states that you didn't carry, the South, by the states, have less than 40% of the Negroes registered to vote. Very interesting to notice that. I think the professor at the University of Texas, a recent article, brought this out very clearly. So it demonstrates that it's so important to get Negroes registered to vote in large numbers in the South, and it will be this coalition of the Negro vote and the moderate white vote that will really make the new South.
That's exactly right. I think it's very important that we not to say that we're doing this and we not do it just because it's Negroes and whites, but we take the position that every person born in this country, when he reaches a certain age, that he have a right to vote, just like he has a right to fight, and that we just extend it, whether it's a Negro, whether it's a Mexican, or who it is. And number two, I think that we don't want special privilege for anybody. We want equality for all, and we can stand on that principle. But I think you can contribute a great deal by getting your leaders and you yourself taking very simple examples of discrimination. Where a man's got to memorize Longfellow, whether he's got to quote the first 10 amendments, or he's got to tell you what Amendment 15, 16, 17 is, and then ask them if they know, and show what happens. And some people don't have to do that. When a Negro comes in, he's got to do it. And if we can just repeat and repeat and repeat, I don't want to follow Hitler. But he had an idea, yeah, that if you just take a simple thing and repeat it often enough, even if it wasn't true, why, people accept it. Well, now this is true, and if you can find the worst condition that you run into in Alabama, Mississippi, or Louisiana, or South Carolina, where I think one of the worst I ever heard of is the president of the school at Tuskegee, or the head of the government department there, or something, being denied the right to cast a vote. And if you just take that one illustration and get it on radio and get it on television, get it on in the pulpits, get it in the meetings, get it every place you can, pretty soon the fellow that didn't do anything but drive a tractor, he'll say, well, that's not right, that's not fair. And then that will help us on what we're going to shove through in the end. And if we do that, we'll break through as it'll be the greatest breakthrough of anything, not even accepting this 64 Act. I think the greatest achievement of my administration, I think the greatest achievement in foreign policy, I said to a group yesterday, was a passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But I think this will be bigger, because it'll do things that even that 64 Act couldn't do.
Great. I should just end there. I should go get off the event, but let me just continue a bit more. LBJ's encouragement of Martin Luther King here to stir things up in the South doesn't mean, as former LBJ aide Joseph Califano claimed, he was irritated by the Selma movie, that the demonstrations that soon followed this conversation in Selma were the president's idea. Dr. King had launched what he called the Alabama Project, in fact, against voting rights violations, with a powerful sermon at the Brown Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church 2 weeks before, 2 weeks before his conversation with the president. And he called Selma in that speech a symbol of bitter end resistance to the civil rights movement in the Deep South. Still, Johnson's overture was important to Dr. King because it gave him hope that the powers of the presidency would be deployed in support of the demonstrations. In the days that followed, Johnson might have had some second thoughts about this call to arms, because the protests of Dr. King and civil rights activists not only aroused massive resistance from local police and state troopers, Bloody Sunday being the worst example of that, but also national demonstrations in support of the marchers, some of which targeted the president for not taking immediate action to avert the violence in Selma. In fact, throughout the Selma controversy, picket lines stood outside the gates of the White House. Nevertheless, when King sought his public endorsement of the Selma campaign, Johnson championed the demonstrators' cause, despite the efforts of his aides to shield him from public involvement of this great crisis. As the president stated at a press conference on February 4th, 1965, "I should like to say that all Americans should be indignant when one American is denied the right to vote. All of us should be concerned with the efforts of our fellow Americans to register to vote in Alabama. I intend to see that that right to vote is secured for all our citizens." And then, to return to where I began earlier in the evening, the following month, as the crisis in Selma worsened, Johnson lived up to this promise. On March 15th, for the first time in 19 years, the president appeared before a special joint session of Congress to present a legislative message. Sensing that America was at a pivotal moment in its long and tortured history of slavery and discrimination, hoping to seize the opportunity presented by the brave civil rights demonstrators, Johnson spoke with unusual feeling about the Voting Rights Act. As even his wife, Lady Bird, admitted, her husband was usually terrible on television. She said he resembled a stuffed moose. But on this night, LBJ rose to the occasion. Just as Lincoln indicted not just the South, God bless you, not just the South, but America for the crime of slavery, so Johnson described its bitter aftermath, the shame of Jim Crow, as an American problem. "What happened in Selma is part of a larger movement," he stated, "which reaches into every section and every state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it is all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice." And then, for effect, his invocation of the Civil Rights Anthem was expressed with dramatic flair, with distinctive emphasis on every word, "And we shall overcome." It's impossible for a Philly guy to talk that soon. LBJ's national televised address, with its dramatic peroration, had not won over Southern congressmen, most of whom slumped in their seats as the joint session erupted in applause. This was more than a hint, of course, of the partisan transformation of Southern politics that would dramatically change the nature of American democracy. Yet Johnson triumphed on an issue that even liberal presidents like JFK had tried to avoid. Significantly, when the president returned to the White House that evening, the protesters were gone. And as Johnson embraced the ringing anthem of the civil rights movement, Dr. King, watching the speech on television in Montgomery, was moved to tears. And the aides who were with him said they'd never seen him move to tears before. As he wrote of the historical address, President Johnson made one of the most eloquent, unequivocal, and passionate pleas for human rights ever made by a president of the United States. He revealed an amazing understanding of the depth and dimension of the problem of racial justice. We had the support of the president in calling for immediate relief of the problems of the disinherited people of our nation. And even some of the more skeptical civil rights activists who had refused to acquiesce to the 1964 MFDP compromise were moved by Johnson's fervent support of what one of his startled advisors called radical changes in the federal government's support of voting rights. John Lewis acknowledged that on this night, LBJ was a man who spoke from his heart, a statesman, a poet. The following week, as I mentioned in my introduction, James Farmer of the Congress of Racial Equality, of CORE, who was also alienated by the MFDP compromise, led his march on the White House to express support and civil rights activist support for the president's efforts, and also to pressure him to keep moving on. But really, in truth, by this point, Farmer was speaking to the converted. LBJ, strengthened by the civil rights activists, pushed the Voting Rights Act relentlessly. This time, there would be no compromise. Although Southern Democrats filibustered against the bill, cloture was easily invoked. And as with the 1964 Act, a large bipartisan coalition of Republicans and Democrats in both houses voted for it. With Farmer, Dr. King, John Lewis, Rosa Parks, and other civil rights leaders sitting in the seats of honor, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act on August the 6th, 1965. Let me try to come to some conclusions. Now, don't get excited, because this is a kind of long conclusion. Not that long, but it's probably too long for a conclusion. The critical uneasy alliance Johnson formed with civil rights activists like Martin Luther King and John Lewis, I think, testifies to how the mating dance between the White House and social movements, despite their different vantage points, can be a critical dimension of fundamental reform. Without the work of Martin Luther King and civil rights leaders in mobilizing demonstrations that elicited the violent reaction of segregationists, and with the new revolutionary medium of television arouse strong support in the country, no civil rights revolution would have been possible. At the same time, without Johnson's willingness to support, in fact, take advantage of the opportunity that Civil Rights Direct Action provided, the landmark laws of 1964 and 65 might never have been enacted. Now, of course, no sooner had the mating dance between President Johnson and the Civil Rights Movement been consummated than their relationship ended in a bitter divorce. You must be getting tired of this metaphor. This was an estrangement over the Vietnam War, which reopened wounds that were still festering from the MFDP compromise. The estrangement between Johnson and the Civil Rights Movement reveals just how fragile alliances can be between presidents and social movements, how fragile they usually are. Yet as President Obama, who was a lineal descendant of the Selma struggles, pointed out 2 years ago in his address commemorating the Voting Rights Act anniversary, the 50th anniversary, just as the country faces new battles over voting rights and police brutality, fought out in the courts and in the streets, and in the streets of places like Ferguson, Missouri, there's little hope of addressing these struggles effectively without a new form of top-down and bottom-up mobilization. The resolution of these issues and their causes related to civil rights, such as establishing a path for citizenship for undocumented immigrants and securing LGBT rights, Obama argued, ultimately depends on presidents and politicians who are willing to sacrifice short-term political gains for the opportunity to pursue ambitious reform. forming a contentious but potentially formative alliance with grassroots activists who can both disrupt and exploit American political institutions in the name of freedom. In fact, for better or worse, the relationship between the White House and social movements has not only become embedded in politics on the left, but on the right as well. The fallout from the collapse of the relationship between Johnson and the civil rights movement, dramatized by riots in almost every major American city during the summers of 1966 and 67, set the stage for the formation of an executive insurgency alliance that spurred a national conservative offensive. Ronald Reagan's political career took off in 1966 with his election as governor of California in a law and order campaign that condemned the excesses of the Great Society. A decade and a half later, like Johnson, Reagan commanded a strong and active presidency that reshaped national law and policy commitments. But Reagan sought to deploy modern executive power to achieve conservative objectives. Many of these conservative objectives, most notably the pursuit of more aggressive anti-communism and the protection of family values, required the expansion rather than the rolling back of the national government's responsibilities. Counterposing the transformation of the Democratic Party during the 1960s, Reagan thus completed the development of an executive-centered, nationalized party system that engaged liberals and conservatives in a polarizing battle for the services of the national administrative state, spawned by the New Deal and elaborated by the Great Society. And just as Johnson facilitated the emergence of civil rights groups as the core constituency of the Democratic Party, so the Reagan Revolution made the Christian right the anchor group of the Republican Party, displacing business from this partisan vantage point. Race and religion, those explosive issues, therefore became the default lines of American politics. The polarized environment of the Obama presidency, the toxic atmosphere of the 2016 election, and the rise of the Trump movement, forgive me for mentioning this, have their origins in the contentious and formative relationship between LBJ and the civil rights movement, echoed in the ties forged between Reagan and the Christian right. Now, certainly, this profound and troubling development doesn't give us cause to condemn the civil rights revolution, perhaps the most important reform program in the 20th century, but it does shed light on how the relationship between presidents and social movement organizations has been institutionalized or ritualized with profound consequences for American democracy. At the dawn of the 21st century, a new form of politics has emerged that defies traditional American pragmatism. It combines executive prerogative, partisan polarization, and social activism. This is a combination that opens American politics to new visions and allows for the possibility of important structural change. But at the same time, such a movement politics divides the country into hostile camps and rattles national resolve. This is the puzzle. This is the conundrum that the fraught but formative alliance between Johnson and the civil rights movement, forged nearly a half century ago, has left us to solve in our own political time. Thank you for your patience.